Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now. I'm going to step off the land now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, that, of course, is the one-of-a-kind audio of Neil Armstrong taking humanity's first steps on the moon. We've all heard those words because NASA kept the original 1969 live broadcast on videotape. But imagine what it'd be like if those tapes had been lost. I mean, if you're younger than 46, would you ever have heard Armstrong's historic words? Well, I'm asking because those tapes did almost get lost. They were deteriorating in storage until 2009 when NASA found, restored, and preserved them. But that's not something we should worry about today, right? I mean, everything is digital and should last forever. Of course, that's not actually the case. This is one of the ironies of the internet age. We're generating more information than ever, and it feels like it should live forever, but we're actually in a race to save disappearing data. So writes Bina Venkatraman in a recent Boston Globe Ideas piece. She's director of global policy initiatives at the Broad Institute. She's also a lecturer at MIT and a former senior advisor for climate change innovation in the Obama administration. And she joins us now in the studio. Bina, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So the title of your piece in the Globe was called The Race to Preserve Disappearing Data. Again, it's a bit of an irony. So can you tell us a little bit about why data is disappearing, you know, even though we're generating it at unprecedented rates?
Sure. And yes, I do think this is one of the sort of underbellies of the digital age. Here we are with all the world's knowledge at our fingertips, but we are impulsively thinking about the short term with a lot of the data we create, whether it's the data from sensors on our planes and power grids, or whether it's the emails we send, or whether it's the films we're creating or the scientific data that we're collecting. Those data are increasingly collected and thought of in a short-term basis, but the knowledge we need to sort of preserve over the long term and for future generations is often being sacrificed at the sort of for the creation of knowledge for the short term. A lot of it has to do with whether people are invested in preserving that knowledge and figuring out ways to store the data, and whether we're thinking about ways to continue to create access for that data over time. One of the great examples of this right now is actually from the film industry, where a lot of films are now being made by independent filmmakers. This is a great thing. We've mm-hmm. unleashed the voices of a new generation of filmmakers. But those filmmakers don't always have their films distributed and preserved by big Hollywood studios, right, as we had in the past. So we're losing a lot of cinema history as a result.
It's up to them to store it, essentially, the independents.
It is, and yeah, often they don't have the budget to do it.
Yeah. Well, so that's one example. In your piece, you had a couple other compelling examples, and the one that really caught my eye was the fact that, you know, okay, there's the question of preserving data in science, right? So the scientific journals in and of themselves, like, they should be archived and backed up, et cetera. But the original raw data that scientists themselves are generating, which is absolutely essential to preserve so that future scientists may be able to go back and dig into that raw data, or, you know, double check original experiments, et cetera, that we're actually having difficulty preserving raw scientific data?
Absolutely. And it's one of the hallmarks, as you note, of science, that we can reproduce findings over time, that a scientist 20 years from now would be able to reinterrogate the data from a scientific study from today and be able to reproduce the results or use those results in a long-term study, say, to look at health trends in a population over a few decades, or to look at how climate change is affecting the coastline in a particular region. But there has been evidence, a study that was done recently of biology papers, 200 biology papers from the 1990s going forward, found that up to 80% of the raw data sets from studies from the early 90s has now been lost as a result of those data sets not being preserved. There not being a budget and grants to preserve them and create access to them over time, and changing formats and ways of storing just sort of the lack of a perspective about preserving them for the long term, with the imperative of publishing the results in the near term.
We see something similar in the world of law, right? Because a lot of briefs that are submitted have links to, like, web links on them that are no longer active. So if someone's looking at the brief a year later, they may the original the source of the information may no longer be available.
Right. And they call this link rot, which I think is a great term. But there was a study done in 2013 that showed about half of the Supreme Court opinions that had web links in them, about half of those links were to dead web pages. Mm. And you can imagine how this might erode some of the intellectual foundations of what of references in the legal world.
Well, the context is missing. Yeah,
it is. And there is an effort at Harvard Law School now to try to go through some of those original Supreme Court opinions that had those web links, as well as a lot of law journal articles, and sort of restore the knowledge that's behind those references.
Mm. Well, listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Are you concerned about the loss of these important cultural, historical, scientific, digital data? What about even your own sort of deluge of personal data? How do you keep up with it? How do you archive it? Or do you just let a lot of it go? How do you decide to keep what to trash digitally? And more importantly, what are we losing when all of our lives are online and that information is rapidly disappearing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Bina, I just want to ask you another quick question that sort of pertains to your own professional experience, right? Because you served in the Obama administration on about climate change innovation. And, you know, I imagine that when you have the job of advising the White House on major issues like climate change, you want to look at a broad base of scientific, legal, historical, cultural references in helping shape policy. So, you know, a Bina 15, 20 years from now, is there a concern that like the loss of data means that the people in our own future won't have that context, that background that could inform, you know, major policy decisions?
I think there's a danger of that. I think you don't want to overstate the danger. A lot of the information that's on the internet, for example, is being crawled by something called the Internet Archive. But there's a lot of information that is not on the internet that is relevant for the future. And sometimes we don't know from the perch of the present what's going to be relevant. And if you take the problem of climate change, for example, ship logs from the 19th century that captains kept were some of the most rigorous and detailed observations of weather patterns, of sunrises and sunsets. And that information has been critical for the long-term climate projections that are being made now that show us how the climate's changing. And so to some degree, it's hard for us to know how the knowledge we're creating now might be useful to the future people who are going to be shaping the world, shaping policy, shaping decisions, leading businesses. Mm. And so I think it sort of behooves us to start to think it from their perspective a little bit more.
Right. And so the challenge is how do we do that? Because earlier in the day, as my producer and I were talking about this conversation that we're having, you know, I remembered that I had spoken not that long ago with a BU archaeologist who was doing a dig on the Boston waterfront before the big dig happened, and she discovered a Puritan privy closet, is what they call it. Basically, it's what, like the garbage can that the Puritans were using in that neighborhood at the time in the 17th century, and it was their junk. I mean, it was the stuff they threw away, but it turned out to reveal enormous amounts about how the Puritans were actually living. Like, they were trading with the Mediterranean in olives. They had lace. I mean, it was stuff that wasn't actively archived or actively remembered by the Puritans to subsequent generations. So I thought about that because there's a central question that you pose in your piece, which is, how do we know what's worth saving?
Right. And often we don't. You know, is it relevant to save your heart rates that your Fitbit is collecting on a daily basis? Probably not. But it might be relevant to save information like home remedies. There's a 9th century Anglo-Saxon manuscript that was found recently that turns out to have a recipe that, by the way, includes the guts of a cow and wine from an historic vineyard in England and onion and garlic. But that recipe is now being investigated for its potential to cure staph infections that are drug resistant in hospitals like MRSA. And so, you know, it's really hard to know, you know, is your home remedy relevant? Is your Fitbit data relevant? Are your emails relevant? But I think it's something we're starting to grapple with, and we can talk about it more with the callers.
Well, listeners, I'm talking to Bina Venkatraman. She is Director of Global Policy Initiatives at the Broad Institute. She's also a lecturer at MIT. She's a former senior advisor for climate change innovation in the Obama administration. And we're talking about the race to save disappearing data. And I want to bring in another voice into this conversation, someone who's actually doing this every day as her living, Kari Smith, who's the digital archivist at the MIT Institute Archives and Special Collections. Kari, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about the sort of scope of the challenge that MIT faces when it comes to preserving digital data? How big is the challenge?
Sure. Well, as Bina was pointing out, it's sort of, you know, all of the production pretty much of what the scholarship, the research, the teaching, the learning, and the just administration of the Institute itself is pretty much all done digitally these days. So our scope within the Institute Archive is to record and document what happens at MIT. So right now it's a pretty large scope, I would say, of being able to acquire and you know, bring in those digital files so that the transparency of what goes on at MIT, the science, the research, how people are teaching here, how people are learning, and then also just the decisions around what is the Institute doing, what are the directions we're going in, what's the new center that they're going to be putting up, and what are the teaching directions. So all of that, being able to keep that information so that when people are interested in knowing, what happened, why was decisions made, what was the research that was done, how can people repeat the science experiments, into the future,
right,
that we have that data available.
Well, and so how do you go about actually doing this? Do you just have vast servers that are sort of scooping up information that's being generated out of MIT's campus?
No, it's actually a much more, I don't know if it's a thoughtful way of putting it, but what we do is, we do a thing called appraisal. So we sort of look at what are the various offices, what are the departments, what are the schools, and of all the information they produce, what of that information do we need to be able to keep for the long term? And sometimes the requirement is legal, or the Institute has already determined what has high value here. Mm-hmm. So we go along with those policies, and currently it's a somewhat manual process as digital goes. It's interesting. So we go out and we find out what is the information that we need to bring in, what are those files, and then we have particular processes using software tools and bringing things onto storage devices, so that in the future we can prove actually that the file we have in the archives was actually the file created by, whichever office or by whoever person. So if somebody needs that as evidence in the future, we can really say we know for sure this was the file they were using or they had created.
Right. And let me ask you, this may sound like a really pedestrian question, but when we talk about digital information, mm-hmm. Unlike a piece of paper, which I don't need an intermediary technology to read what's on the paper, like, you do need technology to decipher, read, understand digital information. So is having the right machine as important as keeping the data as well?
Having the right machine isn't as important as understanding what are the files that you have and how were they created. So one of the first things we do when we acquire digital files is to try and determine or to determine what was the software that was used to create that file. And once we know that, we can use software to transform it into, let's say we want to use that file today. So we can transform, the old software, so let's say WordStar, if you remember WordStar, for word processing, we can transform that into a Word document so you can look at it today, or for preservation, we would save it into an open document format so that, 20 years from now, we could make it available on whatever computer you're using, but in that year's current software program.
Bina Venkatraman, let me bring you back into this conversation. So here we're speaking to Kari, who's doing this day in and day out, and has a clear mandate because MIT knows what sort of its hierarchy of preservable information. I'm just wondering, I'm thinking from the perspective of an individual. It's pretty hard when you don't have the inbuilt infrastructure and intelligence of an institution like MIT. How do you deal with your own deluge of data?
Well, I think people are starting to think about this more and more as they realize that they have thousands or hundreds of thousands of photos they're taking on their smartphone every day. I saw one estimate that we're taking more photos in 2 minutes than were taken in the entire 19th century. And I think people are, particularly with photos and documents, you see people creating multiple storage sites to save them and weeding through them over time. I personally feel like a failure in this regard. I don't go through my photos. I don't go through my documents and my music nearly enough to sort of make sure that I have them backed up in multiple locations. And there's also issues around permissions with some of your files and things that you might think that you own that you've licensed sort of for access, to figure out how you preserve those things over time. And what do we actually own of our digital artifacts right. and knowledge is an interesting question. And I think one of the things that Kari brings up with her comments is the sort of principle, operating principle of digital preservation right now, which is creating lots of copies of files, of digital files, in disparate locations. So a lot of people are working to say, let's maintain things in the cloud, but let's also have them backed up on drives if they're really important, like data sets or master movie files. And doing that is great, but it also raises this new sort of fascinating question for our generation, which is, does it matter to have an original file? And what does the original file mean? What does the format of that file mean? Obviously, if we looked back at the Magna Carta, for example, or the Declaration of Independence, and we saw a photocopy of it or a Word document, updated version of it, we'd think that that wasn't as good as the original. But will that actually persist as a truth in the digital age is an interesting question to me.
Right, especially since so many pieces of information as they're presented digitally are constantly evolving documents anyway, or experiences on the web. Let's take a couple quick calls here. John is calling from Waltham. You're on the air, John.
Hello.
Hi, what's your thought today?
Well, I'm chasing broken links just as I speak with you right now. I do technical writing and maintain a website on bicycle maintenance and repair. And the bicycle component manufacturers are constantly deleting and moving files. It's a real headache. I have to chase some down on the Internet Archive, which I hope you'll be discussing. It's a very valuable resource for finding files that have been lost. And sometimes I just have to look them up with a Google search because they've moved. But, for example, if someone has a 10-year-old internal gear bicycle hub, the information may no longer be available on the manufacturer's site.
Right.
But there are people still using these hubs, and they want to know how to rebuild them.
John, thank you so much for your call. And Bina Venkataraman, I mean, we did talk about the Internet Archive very, very briefly a little earlier, but do you want to just give us a quick summary of what they do?
Sure, and John raises a great point, and his description somehow gave me this visual of him on his bicycle chasing down links and across the Internet. But the Internet Archive is a great example of sort of an economic model to what is really sort of a market failure and economic problem of how do we go about preserving our digital knowledge. The Internet Archive is nonprofit and philanthropic supported, and it crawls the web on a regular basis. And so it's good for, archiving a lot of digital knowledge, but it doesn't capture what lies behind paywalls
That's
and barricades.
Right.
It's very easy for any given site. If you have your own website, for example, you can put in a simple text that will basically block the Internet Archive from crawling your page. And that turns out to be something that certain regimes and certain politicians like to do to sort of make sure that their missteps on the Internet aren't recorded for posterity. But there is, it is a great tool despite that, and it is moving in the right direction in terms of providing an accessible way for people to look up lost knowledge. One of the other challenges that I think the archive is going to have to face going forward, and that's going to be a challenge going forward for future generations trying to search the Internet, is that you have to know what you're looking for when you go to the Internet
Right.
Archive. It doesn't give you sort of the table of contents index of the knowledge yet,
Right.
so you have to go in there surgically.
And also then you have to understand the relationship between sort of between pieces of information. Kari, I hear you there, but there is one more caller I want to get to, and then I'm going to turn right to you briefly. Paul is calling from Cambridge. Paul, we're going to get you in under the wire here, so quickly, what's your thought?
Okay, well, I want to commend you for bringing up this important topic. I think that one of the definitions of intelligence for an individual or a species is whether we can learn from experience, and when we lose all these data, we're effectively forgetting lessons that we've gone to great expense to learn. So
Paul,
keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. I don't think I could have said it better myself. That is one of the big lessons that we're getting here about the race to save disappearing data. Kari Smith at MIT, your response to that?
I absolutely agree with it. And as an archivist, that's often, you know, what we're trying to achieve is to be able to make sure that information is kept over the long term so that people do have that ability to go back and to look at things and to have those lessons learned over time. One thing I just wanted to add on the Internet Archive site was that there's two parts of the Internet Archive. There's the Wayback Machine, which is the one you need the URL for, but also in the Internet Archive, many libraries and archives and societies are also just putting up digital material that you can actually search for, and there's a whole section just on manuals for the sort of products and things like the previous caller was talking about. But if somebody finds a page that they're interested in making sure is archived, there's a Save Page Now button that you can push to say, I think this one should go to the Internet Archive, and proactively make sure material will be available into the future through the Internet Archive.
Kari Smith is a digital archivist at the MIT Institute Archives and Special Collections. Kari, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for all the work you're doing there at MIT.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Bina Venkatraman, Director of Global Policy Initiatives at the Broad Institute and an MIT lecturer, also former senior advisor in the Obama administration and author of this great piece on the race to save disappearing data that appeared in the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, listeners, stay with us. There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.